This episode is brought to you by Amazon Prime. You know Amazon Prime is not just a shipping subscription, right? It's got everything, including streaming TV and movies on Prime Video. And of course, Prime's fast, free shipping. Go from watching your favorite shows to getting your favorite things. Whatever you're into, it's on Prime. Visit amazon.com/prime to get more out of whatever you're into.
Ghosts, UFOs, cryptids, life after death. You'll hear great thinkers on these subjects and more on the Paranormal Podcast, the longest-running podcast of its type. I'm Jim Harold, and I invite you to join me as we explore the mysteries of life. I bet you love these topics just as much as I do, but don't worry, I won't tell anyone. Join me for some great paranormal conversation. Listen on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Blair.
Want to hear something scary?
Join me as I read the creepiest urban legends, folktales, and ghost stories that I learn on my travels around the world and that we receive from listeners like you. But only if you think you can handle it. Listen on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts. Until next time, sweet screams.
Due to the graphic nature of this killer's crimes, listener discretion is advised. This episode includes dramatizations and discussions of murder and assault that some people may find offensive. We advise extreme caution for children under 13. When you think of a nurse, what do you envision? A woman in scrubs, her hair tied back, tending to a patient's needs at the doctor's beck and call? A Victorian war nurse, tending wounded soldiers on the battlefield, like Florence Nightingale or Clara Barton. Or perhaps those of us of a darker bent picture the nightmarish nurses of popular culture, like sadistic nurse Ratched from One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, or Misery's Annie Wilkes.
But what happens when nurses inflict harm on those patients they're paid to tend to help recover from illness or injury? How long can they escape detection by targeting victims who are already sick and hospitalized? Medical students are taught the Latin maxim, primum non nocere, which means first, do no harm. But since the mid-70s, there have been at least 35 serial killers who are healthcare professionals, often referred to in criminology as angels of mercy or angels of death.
Today, we'll be exploring the life of one such angel of death, a female serial killer by the name of Kristen Gilbert. Kristen was a New England nurse, active in the mid-1990s. Who was convicted of killing four patients with a lethal injection of epinephrine.
Her total number of slayings are still debated to this very day, with investigators theorizing that she could have killed up to 80 more victims. To those who knew her, she seemed the epitome of a capable nurse, suburban wife, and soccer mom, a wholesome figure known for volunteering at the local homeless shelter and for her contributions to charity.
But beneath the perfect Stepford wife facade lurked something sinister. A complete disregard, even contempt, for human lives apart from her own. Hi, I'm Claire, and this is Female Criminals. Today, we're going to attempt to plumb the depths of serial killer Kristen Gilbert's psyche, exploring the murders she committed at the Veterans Affairs Medical Center in Northampton, Massachusetts. Her desperate attempts to escape suspicion during the investigation, and her denial of any guilt while on trial for murder. I'm here with my co-host, Vanessa.
Hi, everyone. We'd like to ask a quick favor. Would you leave a 5-star review of Female Criminals on your favorite podcast directory? It seems so simple, but it really helps us out.
And don't forget to subscribe while you're there, because a new episode comes out every Wednesday. You can also find us on Facebook and Instagram at Parcast and on Twitter at Parcast Network.
Often what we find so terrifying and fascinating about serial killers is the Jekyll and Hyde persona, the split between the innocuous person the outer world sees and who they really are, someone capable of killing in cold blood. In the case of female murderers, it seems even more shocking because of how society has viewed women for centuries.
For a long time, many refused to believe women were capable of the savage violence and predatory behavior associated with murder, especially serial murder. They thought women were by nature the softer, sweeter, gentler sex, that life givers were unable to be life takers.
This narrative of femininity allowed many female killers to get away with murder for much longer than their male counterparts. According to Peter Vronsky in his book Female Serial Killers: How and Why Women Become Monsters, female serial killers make up 1 in 6 of all serial killers, either acting alone or as an accomplice.
Even though there aren't as many female serial killers, the ones who are out there can be extremely effective. But what makes them want to kill in the first place?
That's what we're here to explore. So let's take a look at the life of Kristen Gilbert and see what we can find out.
Kristen Heather Strickland was born on November 13, 1967, in Fall River, Massachusetts, while her father lived on a military base in Hawaii, serving as a U.S. Coast Guard.
She was the first child of Claudia Strickland, a substitute teacher, and Richard Strickland, who, after his time in the military, would later become an electronics engineer. Now, I'm about to delve a little deeper into Kristen's psychology here.
Please note, Vanessa is not a licensed psychologist or psychiatrist, but she has done a lot of research for this show.
Thanks, Claire. According to Assistant U.S. Attorney William M. Welch II, who served the prosecution during Kristen's trial, she liked the attention. This pathological need to be the center of attention at all times was perhaps formed in part by 7 years alone as a single child before the entry of her younger sister, Tara, into the family circle.
Kristen was suddenly no longer the center of her parents' world, and her personality seemed to take a darker turn. Seemingly resentful of her baby sister, she became a pathological liar, making up melodramatic stories and frequently stealing things belonging to Tara and her friends.
As an adult, Kristen rarely spoke of her younger sister, but once told a neighbor how her father favored Tara. He built Tara her own treehouse when they were children in the 1970s, but Kristen wasn't allowed to be inside. When she wanted one of her own, her father refused to build it.
Whether this story is true or not, it reveals that Kristen saw herself as the persecuted victim who had to fight for the attention and affection she felt that she deserved from those who stole the spotlight.
Richard and Claudia were said to be very strict with their daughters, but not in a religious sense, as they were both avowed atheists.
If we look at Kristen Gilbert in terms of nature versus nurture, by all accounts, she had an untroubled family life.
According to Michael H. Stone in The Anatomy of Evil, a third of the serial killers he profiled had at least one alcoholic parent, if not both. As far as we know, neither of Kristen's parents abused drugs or alcohol, or either of their children.
On the contrary, they continued to support and defend her even while she was on trial for murder, unable to believe that their beloved eldest daughter could be a monster.
Our research also showed that she had a seemingly normal middle-class upbringing, playing in the school band and joining both the Brownies and Girl Scouts. She spent her childhood in the postcard-perfect small town of Fall River, Massachusetts. Fall River is notoriously best known as where the Lizzie Borden murders took place.
Borden was the infamous Victorian spinster who allegedly slaughtered her parents with an axe. Like Kristen, no one at the time would have thought that a respectable middle-class lady could be capable of such bloodshed, so she was acquitted of murder charges in 1892.
But unlike Lizzie Borden, Kristen would end up behind bars.
Eerily, in middle school, Kristen bragged about being related to Lizzie Borden, likely both to make herself seem special and set apart from the crowd, attention-seeking like any young teenager. It's possible that even then, she might have felt a kinship with the legendary murderess.
There's no evidence whatsoever of any blood relation between the Bordens and the Stricklands, but that wasn't much of a surprise. From a young age, Kristen had developed something of a reputation as a habitual liar.
A friend of Kristen's, Pamela, recalls that she had a penchant for stealing and lying. Once, Pamela couldn't find a favorite shirt of hers after Kristen visited. Later, Kristen showed up wearing the missing shirt, but when Pamela confronted her about it, she denied that it was the same shirt. Ironically, in light of her later crimes, Kristen was, like many girls of the time, obsessed with the melodramatics of soap operas, especially General Hospital. Kristen loved one character in particular on the soap, Amy Vining, an evil nurse known for being cutthroat and ruthless.
Though they're male nurses, the nursing industry is still heavily dominated by women. As of 2011, there were 9 women for every 1 man in nursing. As a result, the popular conception of the profession is one of traditional femininity, stemming back to Florence Nightingale, that of a helpmeet for overwhelmingly male doctors playing the role of a nurturing maternal caretaker.
Because of this, since the 19th century, nursing has been considered a respectable profession for a middle-class lady, despite the often grueling and gut-wrenching work involved.
Over the course of her high school years in the early 1980s, she had a slew of unhealthy relationships in which she played mind games with her boyfriends, even going so far as to stalk and harass them when they angered her by sabotaging their cars or making anonymous threatening phone calls.
Once, enraged that a boy broke up with her, Kristen wrote a suicide note saying she was about to eat glass. Horrified, he hurried over to stop her, only to find she was fine and it was all a ruse just to see him.
It's clear that Kristen engaged in many destructive behaviors. These patterns would reemerge in the future whenever she felt desperate or cornered by law enforcement.
In 1984, at age 16, Kristen graduated early from high school and began studying pre-med at Bridgewater State College in Massachusetts. She had a high IQ and seemed like a model student, a promising young woman with lots of potential. In a yearbook photo from that time, she looks like an ordinary high school student, a smiling brunette.
Around age 18 in 1986, she made her first suicide attempt. The majority of suicides and suicide attempts are carried out by people who are severely depressed with the intention of ending their life. In Kristen's case, however, they may have been ploys for attention and sympathy. We believe that this is a possibility because, in the future, she would self-harm as a way to garner sympathy when under investigation for multiple murders. To clarify, we in no way want to suggest that people who are suicidal or depressed are in any way manipulative or murderous.
The school administration required her to seek psychiatric care, but rather than obey, she transferred to Wachusett Community College for a short time in 1986. Her exes would later claim that she had a history of harassing men, of, quote, making false rape allegations and damaging personal property, end quote.
That same year, 1986, Kristen met her future husband, Glenn Gilbert. He was a soft-spoken, blue-collar worker. She transferred soon to Greenfield Community College, with some sources indicating that she did so in order to be closer to Glenn.
It was only a year later, in August 1987, when she was 19 years old and still in college, that Kristen first tried to harm someone in her care. Perhaps it was even meant to be her first kill.
We'll return to our story in just a moment from the Parcast Network.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
This episode is brought to you by Amazon Prime. You know Amazon Prime is not just a shipping subscription, right? It's got everything, including streaming TV and movies on Prime Video. And of course, Prime's fast, free shipping. Go from watching your favorite shows to getting your favorite things. Whatever you're into, it's on Prime. Visit amazon.com/prime to get more out of whatever you're into.
And now, back to female criminals.
During her college years, Kristen Gilbert made house visits as a home health aide, a supportive role where she would go into patients' homes to tend to them in a very basic manner. At one point, in 1987, she worked for a woman who fostered a deaf blind boy with cognitive disabilities. 19-year-old Kristen's task was to bathe the boy.
One day in August 1987, the foster mother returned to find the boy severely scalded over 60% of his body. His skin burned bright red. Kristen claimed to have no idea how the scalding had happened, but it could only have been done on purpose, as the bathtub faucet had a special lock to keep it set to the right temperature.
The foster mother reported Kristen to her supervisor at the Visiting Nursing Association, but no follow-up was made, nor did she face any consequences.
So while this incident wasn't fatal to the boy, it marked the first time someone under Kristen's care would be harmed.
Healthcare serial killers, or the medical professionals who exploit the fact that healthcare centers are supposed to be houses of healing, know very well that patients make perfect prey, especially ones who are already weak and susceptible to serious illness. Not to mention their deaths are considered much less suspicious than those of someone healthy, and thus are far less likely to be investigated.
After all, who's a better victim than someone already sick, their immune systems compromised? Criminal justice historian Peter Vronsky notes that while only 10% of male serial killers are place-specific, 32% of female killers are, killing either in the domestic space of their own home or in a healthcare institution like a hospital.
As former Special Agent Bruce Sackman, who was part of the investigation of Kristen Gilbert, put it, quote, "After all, who thinks that someone will go into the healthcare profession as a murderer?" End quote.
Whether the scalding of the boy was malicious or accidental, Kristen learned that she was not held responsible or culpable for what had occurred under her watch.
It's hard for most people to believe that a young, pretty nurse from a nice family could be a cold-blooded and unrepentant serial killer.
I guess it makes sense that most female serial killers tend to play the role of caretakers who have sole responsibility over vulnerable individuals, since children, infants, and the elderly make perfect victims.
By the same token, hospitals are places where people die on a daily basis, so a covert killer could go undetected for a long time.
In 1988, just 2 years after they first met, 20-year-old Kristen and Glenn Gilbert eloped. According to court documents, only a month into their marriage, she showed her new husband hints of how deeply unstable she really was by going after him with a kitchen knife during an argument.
Glenn managed to barricade himself inside a room until Kristen calmed down, but it wasn't enough to scare him away. Their life together went on without further incident for a while.
This was only the first of two attempts made on her husband's life, but she would never go through with killing him, instead restricting herself to patients at the hospital where she worked.
It seems she was certainly capable of crimes of passion, given her often volatile and unpredictable behavior toward ex-boyfriends in the past.
It's likely that Kristen didn't focus her murderous intentions on Glenn because she realized she would be the first suspect if her husband was discovered dead of unnatural causes. She was pragmatic enough to recognize that and use the profession of nursing as a smokescreen to take lives instead.
At the end of 1988, 2 years after scalding the little boy, and 1 year after chasing Glenn around with a knife, Kristen graduated from Greenfield Community College around age 21. In 1989, she began to work as a nurse at the Leeds Veterans Affairs Medical Center, or the VAMC, as it is known for short. Shortly after Kristen's arrival on the night shift, an unprecedented amount of patients began to die, like clockwork.
In fact, there were twice as many deaths when Kristen was on duty on the day shift than on the night and evening shift combined. The overall death rate actually increased threefold after she began to work there.
Ironically, and chillingly enough, other nurses on the rounds of Ward C jokingly nicknamed Kristen the Angel of Death, as it was noticed that she was the sole nurse who was always present the majority of times a patient was found dead or dying of cardiac arrest. Unfortunately, it took years for hospital staffers to ever check up on this or report her. Most chalked up the numbers to an unlucky coincidence, hence the nickname.
Kristen had a reputation as a diligent, devoted nurse who stayed calm and cool under pressure. But in reality, this cool head was likely because she wasn't emotionally invested in saving the lives of her patients.
One such unfortunate patient was Lewis Traynor.
Traynor, a 51-year-old manic depressive schizophrenic, had years earlier swallowed Drano in a suicide attempt. He survived and needed a feeding tube.
The night he was admitted to the VAMC, he refused to stop screaming, even though the attending nurses could find nothing wrong with him. At some point in the night, he stopped screaming and was discovered dead.
Traynor showed no sign of life-threatening illness nor acute distress. 22-year-old Kristen had been his primary care nurse.
To play devil's advocate, what's the likelihood of her presence at all of those deaths just being a coincidence?
Statistician Stephen Gelbach was called to present his findings to the grand jury, in which he calculated that the probability of having 40 of the 74 deaths happen when Kristen was on duty was less than 1 in 100 million.
Right. So we can safely rule out coincidence.
Correct. To break that down, in a time span of just over a year, 37 deaths occurred on Kristen's watch, as did 50% of medical emergencies, a far greater number than any other nurse on staff. Over the course of her time at the VAMC, it's theorized that she may have had a hand in over 80 deaths.
Which brings us to her MO, or modus operandi, which, unlike a killer's signature, develops as the result of convenience or greater experience. Kristen's method of killing was ingenious in terms of being nearly undetectable. She injected patients with epinephrine under the ruse of flushing their IV lines.
A heart stimulant, epinephrine is adrenaline, a chemical naturally occurring in the human body and thus very difficult to detect. To someone with a healthy heart, it induces cardiac arrest and is life-threatening. Kristen was well-versed in epinephrine's effects and had been spotted carrying the drug in her smock pocket. As Catherine Ramsland, associate professor of forensic psychology at DeSales University, notes, quote, "Healthcare serial killers generally use some sort of overdose, equipment tampering or smothering, and they are quick to claim when apprehended that their motives were mercy or compassion. In most cases, evidence undermines this claim," end quote.
While rumors swirled about the sudden spike in fatalities on Ward C, Kristen became a mother at age 24, giving birth to son Brian in 1991. Kristen seemed, for all intents and purposes, to be a devoted mother and wife to her family.
Kristen returned to work for maternity leave, having gained weight. She dressed conservatively, looking like the normal suburban mom. She also loved to sew and quilt, even volunteering to run Secret Santas at the local homeless shelter. She was the epitome of domesticity.
But at the same time, she came to discover a different side of herself. One night, when the ward was quiet in 1991, 24-year-old Kristen claimed to have received a bomb threat, causing the building to be evacuated until the police cleared it. Soon after, she claimed to have found a tissue box painted with a swastika, which the bomb squad declared a false alarm.
In addition to receiving, and possibly even planting, false bomb threats, Kristen displayed many behaviors characteristic of serial killers. This included arson and pyromania, which she notably dabbled in as an adult, not a child.
11 fires were set in Ward C between 1990 and 1993, with Kristen finding 8 of them. She even won an award for extinguishing one of the fires.
This follows the established pattern where she would create emergency situations, sound the alarm, and then play the hero, gaining the praise of her peers. According to the FBI's crime classification manual, Kristen likely falls into the category of excitement-motivated arson, particularly within the subgroups of attention seeker and hero recognition.
Kristen seemed to thrive off of causing chaos, excited by the panic she struck in others.
According to Doctors Who Kill, Profiles of Lethal Medics, Kristen Gilbert had traits of both Munchausen syndrome and Munchausen syndrome by proxy. Munchausen syndrome is a mental disorder in which the sufferer injures themselves or pretends to so as to gain attention and sympathy, while Munchausen syndrome by proxy is when someone harms a victim, often a child, to seek attention from medical practitioners.
There are indications that Kristen had tendencies of Munchausen syndrome, repeatedly self-harming and attempting suicide, in addition to harming others in her care. She was treated for 22 injuries over her 7 years employed at the hospital, many of which seem to have been self-inflicted.
But in terms of exhibiting signs of Munchausen syndrome by proxy, Kristen fell into a pattern where she jeopardized her patients' lives by giving them overdoses before calling an emergency code blue and attempting to save them. By helping the emergency team who tried to revive her victims, she was able to appear selflessly dedicated when she was the one who endangered them to begin with.
Things seemed quiet on the home front. However, on her 26th birthday in 1993, she gave birth to her second son, Raymond. Her first son, Brian, was 3 at the time. In 1994, she became close with James Perot, a new security guard who worked with her at the hospital.
1 year later, in 1995, her marriage of 8 years was showing signs of wear and tear. Kristen became obsessed with designer brands, buying and returning expensive clothes compulsively, often after wearing them only once.
She longed for the finer things in life, status symbols that her blue-collar husband Glenn wasn't able to provide her. Rumblings of marital discontent emerged as she seemed to undergo a personality change, transforming herself from the inside out.
She told coworkers she was related to British royalty with a seemingly pathological need to be the center of attention.
Chameleon-like, she went on a strict diet regimen, lost weight, and began to dress provocatively. She changed her hairstyle often, going from brunette to blonde, and even bought a fake nose ring. She began to go out and party after work, when for years she had gone straight home to her family after long hours at the hospital.
Perhaps Kristen needed excitement and adrenaline to liven up her life. She seemed to thrive off of being the calm, capable center of a high-stress situation. It could be that ordinary married life, kids, suburban domesticity, simply just became too boring for her. She needed to make her life and herself exciting again.
Or maybe this was all a side effect of her falling in love. Kristen and security guard James Perot began a secret affair sometime in 1994 or 1995, often having sex in the back of Kristen's car.
Falling in love may have been a catalyst for these changes, or perhaps Kristen's thrill-seeking is what led her to this infatuation. It's impossible to know.
It was during this time of Kristen's personal transformation, in the summer of 1995, that Glenn noticed his food started to taste strange and began making him violently sick. When examined in a hospital, he was discovered to have dangerously low potassium levels, unlikely in a healthy 30-something-year-old man.
Female serial killers have long been associated with murder by means of poison, a passive method of killing that does not involve direct butchery on the victim. Since women have traditionally performed domestic household duties, such as cooking and serving food, it was simple to slip poison into someone's meal without immediate suspicion. That's how killers like Nanny Doss were able to get away with murder for over 3 decades.
Nothing has ever been definitively proven in terms of Kristen poisoning him. For as suddenly as the illness-inducing meals started, they stopped just as abruptly, as if Kristen most likely had a change of heart.
But soon she started flaunting her relationship with Perot. Given that Perot was required to help out whenever a code was called, it comes as no surprise that Kristen began to call more emergency codes to see him and impress him with her nursing prowess.
In hospitals, code blues are called to bring in an emergency resuscitation team. In this case, most code blues on Ward C were called when Perot was on shift, likely so that he could see Kristen in action. She was utterly heedless of the lives she was putting at risk, just so she could show off for her lover, reveling in the excitement of an emergency. Kristen's coworkers said that she loved to show off and freak them out by showing off her double-jointed contortionist skills. But just as she could twist her body unnaturally, so too could she warp the truth according to her own distorted version of reality.
Which might explain why her first confirmed kill didn't happen until 1995, 6 years after patients started dying in her care. Our story will continue in a moment after the break. And now let's continue our story. In 1995, the same year Kristen Gilbert transformed herself, and shortly after she began an affair with James Perot, 27-year-old Kristen took the life of her first confirmed victim. He was a Korean War veteran by the name of Stanley Jagodowski.
At age 66, he was obese and suffered from diabetes. He was a frequent patient at the VAMC during his recovery. He had to have one of his legs amputated due to gangrene. On August 21, 1995, at 8:20, he seemed to be in stable condition.
Just 20 minutes later, there was a blood-curdling shriek from his room, where he had been left alone with Kristen, who walked out nonchalantly.
Stanley complained his arm hurt, and moments later went into sudden cardiac arrest. So an emergency code blue was called to resuscitate him. He was revived and taken to the ICU, where at 9:30, Kristen came in and relieved another nurse on duty, who noted she was carrying a syringe, which wasn't out of the ordinary.
Code blues were called on Stanley another 2 times that night, and by 11:38, he was dead. Given that epinephrine is known to be extremely painful to have injected, it's no surprise he screamed out in pain.
On his progress report, Kristen had written, quote, "Today, patient was noted to be confused and lethargic. Edema and modeling of upper extremities noted," end quote.
None of the other doctors or nurses on duty noted any of these changes to Jagodowski's condition. Kristen had falsified the medical report to escape suspicion.
By the fall of 1995, Kristen Gilbert was living dangerously. She was growing more careless at work, and given she was poisoning patients with a drug to induce heart failure, this was a dangerous prospect indeed.
Kristen and Glenn divorced in December of 1995, just after Kristen's 28th birthday. But during the divorce proceedings, the two still lived together with their children.
Kristen came home one day and offered to test a blood sample of Glenn's to check his potassium levels. He allowed her to inject him with a syringe of what she claimed was saline, but as soon as the fluid hit his bloodstream, he passed out. When he awoke, Kristen insisted he had just passed out at the sight of the needles. He didn't push the issue.
It's possible that on some level, Glenn still trusted her, maybe even still loved her, and at least at this point didn't believe that she was capable of actually going through with seriously harming him or anyone else. He would eventually go so far as to plead against the death penalty on her behalf, so that their two sons would still have a mother, just an incarcerated one.
In hindsight, it seems pretty clear she was using her soon-to-be ex-husband as a guinea pig for her practice administering lethal injections. Like epinephrine, potassium is naturally found in the body, but in large quantities is very dangerous to a healthy heart. In fact, it's the drug used in execution by lethal injection.
Even more significantly, two other nurses saw Kristen raiding the medical supply closet where she claimed to be getting more potassium for Glenn as he'd run out of his prescription, but that wasn't the only potassium-related incident that year.
On December 8, 1995, Kristen called four emergency codes throughout the night on 35-year-old Henry Houdon, a paranoid schizophrenic patient who was recovering from the flu. He was brought back to life once due to the quick-thinking doctor on duty. But despite his condition seeming to have stabilized, he was declared dead after Kristen called in the fourth code.
She had injected Henry with potassium chloride and his heart stopped. In between inducing cardiac arrests in Henry, Kristen occupied herself by emailing Perot about directions to a Christmas party they planned to attend together. According to research compiled in Social Psychology by Sharon S. Bram, Saul M. Kassin, and Stephen Fine, this sort of behavior exemplifies Kristen's moral hypocrisy, a pattern of behavior that occurs when individuals, quote, deliberately hurt or endanger others so they can swoop in and apparently try to save the day, end quote.
But even more chilling was the case of Kenny Cutting. In February of 1996, Cutting was the only patient in the 30-bed acute care unit and suffered from severe multiple sclerosis. 28-year-old Kristen asked the supervising nurse, RN John Wall, if she could get off work early in the event Cutting died. Interestingly, John Wall would later be one of the three nurses on Ward C to blow the whistle on Kristen due to his suspicion that they had a serial killer in their midst.
An hour later, Cutting's body was being taken to the morgue, and Kristen was able to leave work at 10 p.m. to meet up with her lover, Perot. Without direct intervention from another nurse or doctor on staff, it would have been hard for a patient to escape their fate once Kristen had decided to kill them.
Luckily, two of her intended victims were able to escape death at her hands, Thomas Callahan and Angelo Vello. In the mid-90s, they were resuscitated with the hard work of the code team of emergency paramedics, of which Kristen was a member. Vello believed that Kristen had intended to harm him, accusing her of injecting him with something that made him numb and made his heart feel like it was going to explode.
But patients continued to drop like flies whenever Kristen was on duty. While some were old or overweight, most were not in severe danger nor terminally ill. Deaths due to cardiac arrest spiked in patients with no history of heart trouble.
Meanwhile, Kristen was only concerned with seeing Perot as much as possible while at work, and facilitated this by creating emergency situations, calling code blues where they would have to both be present.
She lied on death certificates about cause of death or foregoing recording vital signs of the patients. In short, she was increasingly reckless and getting sloppy.
Other nurses on the ward were beginning to suspect her in the rash of untimely deaths, not to mention the epinephrine shortage. On February 17, 1996, three nurses, John Wall, Kathy Ricks, and Renee Walsh, inform the hospital administration of their suspicions regarding Kristen.
Hospital management had finally called in a forensic pathologist to investigate the suspicious deaths, with Kristen as the prime suspect. Though still working at the VAMC, she was being watched closely.
But Kristen didn't enjoy being under a cloud of suspicion. She grew paranoid and desperate, even claiming that a patient had assaulted her despite no supporting evidence. She attempted suicide and overdosed on Fiorinol, which led to her taking a medical leave of absence. She was hospitalized at Mount Holyoke Hospital in the summer of 1996.
Tellingly, there were only 4 deaths and 2 medical emergencies in the 4 months after her leave of absence in 1996, compared to 23 deaths and 30 emergencies in the 4 months preceding her suspension.
It was only once Kristen took that leave of absence that the death rate at the hospital fell dramatically back down to 1988 levels of 10 deaths per year on each shift. 1988 happened to be the year predating her arrival on Ward C.
Beginning in her college years, Kristen had been institutionalized for attempting suicide, but it was only in July of 1996, when Kristen was 28, that doctors at Holyoke Hospital diagnosed her with borderline personality disorder, as well as narcissistic personality disorder and antisocial personality disorder. But once again, she refused any treatment.
In August 1996, Kristen told her neighbor Samantha that because Perot loved her cats so much, she was planning to have them euthanized and leave their bodies on his doorstep. Her ego was so monstrous, her jealousy was so all-consuming, she was unable to allow her boyfriend to show affection for anyone else, even her own cats.
According to Dr. Sam Vaknin, author of Malignant Self-Love, Narcissism Revisited, a major component of the narcissist is self-absorption, to the point that it imperils relationships. Narcissists are the ultimate egotists, oversensitive to any imagined slight, arrogant and unafraid to exploit people shamelessly to serve their own agenda. Kristen displayed many of these hallmarks, from showing no remorse for her crimes to her pathological need to be the center of attention at all times.
Much later, while awaiting trial in prison, Kristen even wrote a thinly fictionalized autobiographical novel about the crimes, of course starring herself as the main character named Heather, notably given her own middle name. Heather was made the innocent scapegoat, framed for murder and persecuted by the government, the police, the judge, and jury.
Dr. Vaknin contends that those diagnosed with narcissistic personality disorder truly see the world only in terms of their own needs and wants. Other individuals exist to serve as tools for them to use as they see fit, not as human beings with their own dreams, desires, and agency.
So, basically, not to oversimplify things, Kristen saw other people as chess pieces for her to move around the board, and herself as the chess master.
And when she felt like it, she would remove pieces from the board without a second thought or twinge of conscience. An unabashed egomaniac, she also loved the celebrity the trial brought her. For an attention-seeking narcissist, the most negative notoriety is better than a life lived in obscurity. It confirms their inflated sense of self-worth, their superiority complex, and their feelings that they aren't bound by the same mundane rules as the rest of humanity.
350 patients had died between 1989, the year she began working at VAMC, and 1996, when her crimes were discovered. This amounted to roughly one death on her shift per month, a rate which spiked to an average of one per week in her last 6 months on the ward. Half of the 350 deaths occurred during the time Kristen was on duty, a death rate which had tripled compared to the 1988 death rates.
Kristen's institutionalization at Mount Holyoke in July of 1996 probably saved the lives of plenty of veterans at the VAMC.
It would only be 3 months after Kristen's diagnosis, in October 1996, that she was taken into police custody for murder.
And little did she know that she had been betrayed by the one person she loved most.
Thank you for listening to Female Criminals. Join us next week to delve deeper into the investigation, the trial, and Kristen's increasingly unhinged attempts to save herself and clear her name, using voice-altering toys and bomb threats to try to outwit the police. Remorseless to the end, Kristen was on a rampage, desperate to save her own skin, no matter the cost.
Don't forget to subscribe to Female Criminals on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or any other podcast directory, or through our website, parcast.com. That's parcast.com.
A new episode of Female Criminals comes out every Wednesday. Please let us know what you think and join the conversation on our Parcast Facebook page. You can tweet us at Parcast Network. That's Parcast Network.
As always, thank you for listening. Female Criminals was created by Max Cutler, is a production of Cutler Media, and is part of the Parcast Network. It is produced by Max and Ron Cutler, sound designed by Carrie Murphy, with production assistance by Ron Shapiro and Paul Mahler. Additional production assistance by Carly Madden and Maggie Admire. Female Criminals is written by Caroline Klimchuk and stars Claire Delamar and Vanessa Richardson.